Baptist Church, and learned a lot of background material. Sister Laura as well as Brother Matt learned a lot of background material we'll use if he gets out of line. So they've given me things, but also I might have spread a few tall tales on him too while I was there. So, but I had a good time and enjoyed the church there, and then came back home and was here a week, and then in behalf of my clients, I had to go up to Washington, D.C. Spent several days up there trying to help them. You know, I helped the utilities that serve rural areas. That's my primary client base with my law firm. And so they send me to Washington once a year to work with the other cooperatives from around the nation to lobby Congress. And while you're there, you know, of course, you know, I studied political science and government while I was in school, and I guess I'm what you would call, according to New Testament, a Herodian. Herodians were the Jewish people who worked with the Roman government. Matthew was said to be a Herodian because he was a Jew, but yet he was a tax collector for the Roman government, so he kind of supported the government. So that's me. Y'all know I've been, anybody that knows me knows I've been partial to government, and I generally enjoy politics. Right now, politics is not so enjoyable. It's really depressing. Our government right now is so mired in politics. You know, I understand the reason for political parties and that type of thing, but when you get to Washington, D.C., once you get elected, that to me should end, and you should just serve what's the best interest of your people back home. And I don't feel like that's going on. We're ending up into partisan fights. The Republicans, Democrats, fighting each other, and a lot of the decisions they make are purely for their own interest or for their own party interest, you know. And some of the fights that go on these days, you wonder, this is not going to be a political sermon, by the way. you wonder whether or not, you know, that have we ever seen anything like this, this partisan and this crazy. You know, you think, this is such a mess that, you know, sometimes you wonder, you know, that can the Lord solve this problem when it gets in this kind of a mess? And you look back, and I want to look back. I said I was going to go to the 22nd chapter of Matthew real briefly. This is just kind of an introductory because it's been on my mind after being in Washington. In the 22nd chapter of Matthew, we see there that the Lord was confronted by the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians trying to entangle him in his talk. And that's where, you know, the Pharisees who hated the Herodians, they combined with them, though. Politics makes strange bedfellows. They got together and tried to entangle him and said, you know, should we pay taxes to our government? And that's where Jesus, if there's anybody that, you know, us lawyers like cross-examination, but if there's anybody I would not want to cross-examine, it would be Jesus. He's not smarter than all the rest of it. He turned around and entangled them back. You know, you don't answer a fool according to his folly, but you use his folly to answer him. You know, that's one of the Proverbs, and Jesus did that. He said, you know, that's where he came out with, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and render unto the Lord the things that are Lord. But also there we see the Sadducees questioning. And the Sadducees don't believe there's any resurrection. So they ask him this trick question about, you know, it's under the law, but this woman ended up marrying seven different brothers. Each one of them died, and so under the law, the next brother's supposed to step up and marry. So it says, and that was the Sadducees' trick question about when she gets to heaven, which one's going to be her husband? Because she'd have married all seven brothers. And Jesus, number one, has come again. He used his great teaching tool. He said, number one, you err not knowing the scriptures. That's something for all of us. We all err not knowing the scriptures. But then he went ahead and says, but in the resurrection, there won't be any husbands and wives. There won't be any. We'll all be alike together. We'll all be brothers and sisters. No fathers, no mothers, no children. We'll all be brothers and sisters together in Christ. It's a great lesson. But there, if you read that and study that, you start studying the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were both political, religious parties. They didn't get along at all. Now look, they're reading the same scriptures. At that time, the New Testament didn't exist. This is recorded in the New Testament, but all that existed was the Old Testament. So they're reading the scriptures of the Old Testament, and they have a complete disagreement on the resurrection. you know, just in their own opposite sides of that. And they got in fights over it all the time during when they had the meetings of their council, the Sanhedrin. And Apostle Paul recognized that over in the book of Acts. There's a story where he was brought for a trial before the Sanhedrin. And he recognized they fight all the time. So he brought up the resurrection, got him into a fight so he could slip out. And he got out the door without harm because he got him into a fight. But the Sadducees and the Pharisees read the same book, same scriptures, the Old Testament, and they had two completely different interpretations of it. You know, if you go forward in history, you can see that, go back to the days of the, in England, of the Whigs and the Tories. They had the same British laws, but they took two completely different sets of interpretations to them. You go back to, the Sadducees and the Pharisees had two different readings of the Old Testament, even though they're reading the same thing. If you put the New Testament in place, which we've got in place now, you look, you have the Calvinists that say we're saved by predestination. You have the Arminians that say we're saved by salvation by works. They're reading the same scriptures, and they come up with two completely different interpretations. Go look at them at the Muslim world right now. They've got one book, the Quran. A lot of it's based on some of the Old Testament. We both go back to the same father in Abraham. But they're reading the same Quran, and they have two completely different interpretations of it. The Shiites have one interpretation, kind of the more liberal one. The Sunnis have a totally different interpretation that's a more radical one. But it's the same book they're reading, but yet they've got two different interpretations of them. Go to Washington, D.C. today. You got the Democrats and the Republicans. They both have the same Constitution. You know, you go, especially the easy examples, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. Democrats have one reading of that. The Republicans have another reading. They're reading the same thing, and they have two different interpretations to it. Satan is still at work. He was at work back then, giving men two different minds and leading them astray, of which he'll do to us today if we don't know the scriptures. He'll do that to us today. He's been doing it all along. What's going on today is not new to the Lord. If you look back in history, it's been going on all the time. From the Sadducees, Pharisees to the Calvinists and the Arminians, the Apostle Paul had to address the Epics and the Epicureans and the Stoics. They had two different interpretations of life. Satan has been dividing people all along. That's his best weapon, is to divide people. And you see, it's still taking place today. It's taking place in Washington, D.C. You know, you can't let yourself get upset at what's going on, because it's been going on throughout history. If you go back and read 1 Samuel, when the people were crying for, give us a king, give us a government, give us a president, but they were in that time, give us a king. Our presidency and our form of government is like the kings of other countries. That's the way we have a little multiple-headed government, whereas they used to have kings, but it's the same thing. The people were crying to Samuel, give us a king. And, you know, they ended up with Saul, which didn't turn out to be the kind of king they wanted. But Samuel, if you go back and read first few chapters of Samuel, Samuel says, let me tell you what you're going to get when you get a king. You're not going to like it. First of all, he's going to start taxing you. Does that sound familiar? He's going to start taxing you. He's going to start drafting your young men and women into service. He's going to take all the money that he gets in government and use it for his own purposes and use it to build chariots and war and build himself up. He gives them the exact warnings that we see today, that when we see problems with our government. Go back and read Samuel. We've already been through this. Samuel already went through this. And if you go read, I believe it's about the 12th chapter of 1 Samuel, Samuel tells the people, now, you've got your king. You've got him. That's what you've wanted, and you got him now. But let me tell you this. If you'll continue to praise the Lord and carry your problems to him, then the Lord will bless not only you, but he'll bless your government. Now, our job is to pray to the Lord, and our job is to praise him and ask him to solve these problems. We can't figure out how to solve them, we've been trying for 200 years in this country alone. We've been trying for 2,000 years to solve all the splits and all the governments they've had. Our job is to pray to the Lord, follow his commandments and mind him, and let him solve the problems that are out there. Solomon tells us, you know, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. That hasn't changed. The Lord can fix this problem when none of us can. So our job is to go to him. I take our prayers, and we ought to be praying daily for our government, for our leaders, and for, in fact, we're supposed to pray also for our enemies around the world, that the Lord might be able to solve those problems his way according to his will. So that's my little political sermon for the day, and that is our allegiance goes to the Lord. We give him honor and glory and ask him to fix our problems. I don't normally pick the days, what's going on, to base a sermon on, but I'm doing that today. Today is Mother's Day. It's a special day for us, Mother's Day. I have a subject on my mind I want to talk to you about, hopefully something that will have some meaning to all of us. But today is Mother's Day, and this is a day that we've created, man has created. It started in Boston about 1870. They started having a locally there a Mother's Day. And about 1914, 15, 30 or 40 years later, President Woodrow Wilson declared the second Sunday in May, one of these presidential proclamations, he declared it to be Mother's Day, second Sunday in May. And so it's been one of our official holidays since. Mothers are special. They're special to all of us. You know, we're all close to our mothers. Us dads kind of take a back seat to the mom and moms in this regard, and that mothers are special. They're special to all of us. You know, we know mothers are not perfect, and some of you may feel like if you've been through this raising of children, you think, well, I didn't raise them very well, not like I really wanted to. Well, God gives you a second chance because he also gives us grandmothers. So what you don't do as a mother, you make up for as a grandmother. We know that mothers are not always perfect. Grandmothers are always perfect. So we can't go wrong with grandmothers. You know, it's been said that there's two sets of perfect people in the world, and that's grandparents and grandchildren. That group in the middle is the one that's messing everything up. So we have a special place in our hearts for mothers. The Bible gives us wonderful examples of some of the meaning of mothers throughout our history. Mothers, we know, are the glue that holds the families together. We've all got different roles to play, and that's sometimes people get confused up in the world about the roles of mothers and fathers. And you know, and I'm a believer in equal pay for equal work, all those type of things. I'm under the law. I'm trained in the law, so I believe that very strongly. But we teach in our families and in our church, we have different roles, and the Lord's created those. And when we follow those, everything seems to work well. The Lord makes it clear. He doesn't diminish the role of the mother or the father, but they're equal, and in fact, they're supposed to work together as one. That's the way the family unit was created, and that's the way it's supposed to be in the home. Now, we've got different roles. I can't play the role of a mother. I don't have the compassion that mothers do. I don't have that loving touch that mothers do. And no matter how old you get, I have fond memories of my mother. I'll start thinking about my mother, and I'll swell up, and I'll get tears in my eyes, and I'll get choked up. That's the role of mothers. My dad, I'm close to him, was probably closer to my dad than physically sense of being close to them and working with them and love my dad. But I don't have that same deep spiritual feeling as I do with my mother. Mothers are just special. They're the glue. Over in the first chapter of Proverbs, Solomon writes, and one thing he tells us, warns the young men to do, young men and women, but he warns them, he said, you know, you should follow the instruction of your dad, but obey the law of the mother. Mothers make law? Did in my house. You know, I learned how to work with my dad. My dad, I was a printer's devil growing up in a print shop, newspaper shop, and so I learned how to do that, and you work and you get messy. And of course, we know the man's work environment is never as pure as it ought to be, and things go on every now and then. I tell the joke about I work with my dad, and my dad would send us out to get something to eat, and we get something to eat, and we'd be eating it. And then, you know, as young boys will do, we'd love to have a contest in which we see who could belch the loudest. You know, and my dad would frown upon that and look at us, but I could tell you, but we knew that went on, and we'd laugh about it and joke about it. I could tell you one thing I did not do. I did not belch at my mother's dinner table. That was the law in the house, and we didn't do it. My mother taught us how to live. My mother taught me how to cook. Before I went to college, my mother taught me how to cook. My mother taught me how to wash my clothes. My mother took care of me, and when I had problems in that nature, I'd go to my mother. My mother teaches us the laws. That's why mothers are special to us. You know, we've seen some crazy examples in this world of things that have gone on and occurred. Being in the law, I'm familiar from time to time with maybe someone who's committed a heinous crime and has to go and is sentenced to death at Huntsville. And so us lawyers follow those type of things. Nearly every time in Huntsville, when someone's about to die, and now it's the gas chamber, it used to be the electric chair, still the gas chamber, and Texas, good or bad, seems to lead a lot of the nation in executions. But they'll tell you the statistics are when it comes time to execute someone, some man that's created some bad crime, one of the individuals that almost always shows up to witness that is the mother. The mother, you know, the mother still loves their child. That's the love of a mother. If you've been raised on a farm, you know better than to get between a mother cow and her calf. That's something you don't do. Mothers have that love that, again, we take a second hand. Us men take a second place to mothers in that regard, in the closeness. Even in the, you know, in the world, I witness a lot. I'm a big sports fan, and so, you know, I'll see the love of men, grown men, and how they break down and cry when they talk about the mother. I know Earl Campbell graduated from the University of Texas, real poor family in East Texas. They barely could survive, and he got a scholarship and, of course, won the Heisman Trophy. And the day he won the Heisman Trophy and he signed a pro contract for I don't know how many millions of dollars, the first thing he's going to do, I'm going to build my mother a home in Tyler, Texas, build my mother a new home. When he's accepting that trophy, he broke down in tears as his mother, and he said, you know, when I get in a tough spot, I call on my mother. And he said, Mother, I'm choking up and I can't speak. I need your help now. He was calling on his mother. We'll see these grown men that'll break down. Texas Tech this year had the fortune to go to the National Basketball Championship and play the final game. Had two players on that are from foreign countries, one from France and one from Italy. And the coach, in the last playoffs, their parents had never seen them play. And he arranged it where the parents could fly over here. And when he was having his workouts, he would say, we would stop for a minute, and he'd talk about the importance of family and have kids speak on the family, and he'd have one of the mothers then come walking out. And you see this big 6'10 guy, powerful, he'd break down in tears as he'd go hug his mother. Shake hands with his dad, but he'd hug his mothers. Mothers are known in the Bible for the ones that have special meaning to all of us. A good example of this is in 2 Samuel chapter 20 chapter 21, when Saul was killed. Saul was the king of Israel, you know, and David followed him, and Saul was killed, and his sons were hanged. He had several of his sons, all seven sons, were hanged, hung out, and died. And his wife, who had been the mother of those seven sons, was Rizpah, R-I-Z-P-A-H. And we're told Rizpah went out to where the sons were hanging. It says, and Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, took ashcloth and spread it for her upon a rock. She made herself a pallet on the rock next to where all her sons were hanged to die. And from the beginning, and they were hanging and had to hang up there and continue hanging until it rained. Well, it didn't rain for months. But she says, she beginning of harvest until water dropped from them in heaven, and she suffered neither the birds of the air or the rest of them by day or night, nor any of the beasts of the fields. She protected the bodies of her sons, her dead sons, that were laying and I'm sure decaying and rotting on those, wherever, however they were hanged. She went out and protected them from wild animals and the buzzards to keep them attacking. Wonderful examples of this. We know Moses, when he was going to be killed by the king of by the Pharaoh, his mother put him in an ark and put him in a boat, sailed him so she'd get harm, and then she was hired back. And the way the Lord works, she was hired back to be his mammy back in the house of the Pharaoh. We have wonderful examples in the Bible of mothers and what they've done. So, you know, over in Timothy, in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5, when Apostle Paul is addressing Timothy, one of the first things he does, he gives credit to Timothy's mother and grandmother for their training of Timothy. Verse 5 of chapter 1 of 2 Timothy, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, when I remember how faithful you are, Timothy, he said, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in thee also. Apostle Paul was giving appreciation and credit to Timothy's mother and grandmother for raising him right. You can go back into 2 Timothy, I believe it's chapter 5, where Apostle Paul tells us, one of the duties of the church and us is to take care of the widows and the mothers and the grandmothers, the widows, especially those that are widows with children. Apostle Paul gives us that lesson always. We're to give special attention. You know, it doesn't say much about the widowers ever throughout here. They're supposed to, that's men who can generally take care of themselves in that regard in the world. But he says we're to take special attention to take care of the widows and mothers in the church. Over here in John chapter 19, when Christ was on the cross, he was dying. And one of the last things he did when he was dying was make sure his mother was taken care of. And he appointed John to do that. He told John, he said, he told his mother, "Woman, behold thy son," pointing out John, and told John, "Behold thy mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. Jesus made sure that he took care of his mother before he died. The one I want to point out to you today, 2 Samuel chapter 11. The one I want to point out to you today, and I hope that's where the lesson is, one I want to focus the rest of my time on today, a mother, and that's the mother that is the role model for a lot of mothers, and that's Bathsheba. Bathsheba is not one you normally think of as a role model. We know, and I'm not going to get into the details of her problems with David. We know that they engaged in adultery. But I want us to look at the lessons from this because Bathsheba is a very much a role model for women. We only see one side of her. We only see the bad side of her. She was just some kind of a vixen, whatever. It's the way she's portrayed too many times with her and David. And then we go on and talk about David being king. I want us to look a little bit at the scriptures of Bathsheba a little bit. And let's talk about what took place. We know that her and David, beginning in 2 Samuel chapter 11, her and David gotten together. But let's look, first of all, at who Bathsheba was. 2 Samuel 11, verse 3, "And David sent and inquired after the woman that he saw bathing, and one said, 'This is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite.'" Well, if you'll go to, you see there in 11 and 3, tells who she was. She was the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. But if you jump over to Samuel chapter 23, verse 34, this is talking about, let me back up here, this is talking about the men of David, the valiant men of David. I've lost my word now, the honorable, valiant, the men that worked for David. What's the word, do you know?
Men of valor.
Men of valor for David, all that worked for King David. These were godly men that David had surrounding him. In verse 34, it talks about one, and it says, "And Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gileadite." Eliam, Bathsheba's father, was one of the men of valor of David, one of his honorable men. And Eliam was the son of Ahithophel. If you go back and look and see who Ahithophel was in 2 Samuel 16, he was David's counselor. And when you see about him being David's counselor, let me go back there and see if I can find it. I think it's in 16, because it said, "He gave such sound advice, it was almost like words from the Lord. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days to David, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and Absalom." Ahithophel was the counselor, and it says when he spoke, it was almost as if God speaking himself. So that was her grandfather. Her father was Eliam, one of David's men of valor. Both her father and grandfather were considered very close to David and both men of God. And in verse 39 of 2 Samuel 24, Uriah the Hittite was the 37th of David's men of valor. So she was in she grew up in a godly home. Her father was one of David's closest men and a man of valor and a man close to the Lord. And Ahithophel, when he spoke, that's her grandfather, was almost as if it was hearing from God directly, according to Scripture. And then her husband was the last man of valor that David had chosen. She came from a very godly family. Like you said, she was raised right. We know that David, after this incident occurred, when David was confronted by Nathan, we'll see that when Nathan rebuked him, if you notice who Nathan blamed, there's not a word in there about Bathsheba. Nathan lays all the blame upon David. Now, you know, I know it takes two to tango, so she was involved in this too. But Nathan says the blame goes to David. If you go back and look, David saw her. He saw her when he shouldn't have seen her, when he should have been out at war. He was there watching her and saw her. And then he inquired about who she was, and he knew she was married, and knew he was married to one of his best soldiers, knew he was the son of another one, and knew he was the grandson of his counselor. And yet he still went after her and pursued her. He lays the blame to David. That doesn't mean that she's not the fault, but she clearly lays the blame on David. I'm skipping around here in Samuel's a little bit, but Nathan challenges him and lays the blame to him. Now, we know that David and Bathsheba have a child, and the Lord disciplines them in that, and they lose that first child. But then we have it where she has Solomon. When she has the birth of Solomon, which is in 2 Samuel 12, verse 24, David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. Now, if you'll look, you know, her and Bathsheba got together because of adultery. David and Bathsheba got together because of adultery. Well, you know, we know what that is under the law, and I'm not going to preach on that today, but the law on that's pretty strict and disciplined. But look, here it says, David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. The Lord blessed that marriage. Now, that didn't stop either one of them from having been an adulterer in the past, but that shows you the grace of God and what it does. And we're fixing to see how the Lord blessed Bathsheba in that marriage. Tells us today how the Lord can take something that's been perhaps a violation of the law, and not only by the grace forgives it, but he elevates it to work for him. It says they had, when David and Bathsheba got together, they had a son, and she called his name Solomon, and the Lord loved him. The Lord experienced great grace here to Bathsheba and her son to Solomon. They also had three or four other sons, one of which they named Nathan. They named it after the prophet that came and rebuked David. They turned around and had a child and named it Nathan. Now, if you'll go look in Matthew 1, you'll see that we know Solomon was in the chain heritage for Jesus. In Matthew, you see that where it talks about David bare a son, Solomon, with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. And so we know that Jesus is in the lineage of Solomon that way. But if you go look in Luke chapter 3, you'll see that, and that's Mary's, we strongly believe that's Mary's lineage, that you'll see Nathan in that chain in there. So Bathsheba, two of her sons, of David and Bathsheba, were in the lineage, one coming down to the side of Joseph and one coming down to the side of Mary. They blessed it. So both of these men were blessed to be in the heritage, both of them a product of this marriage between David and Bathsheba. I keep getting back, keep starting to get my names correct. But we have them where they had both been this probably improper relationship in violation of the law, and yet the Lord has forgiveness and blesses that. I hope we could look at that in today's world and say that from time to time the Lord blesses these type of situations. Only he can do and give forgiveness. Now, next step that we see Bathsheba that I'm going to jump to is up in 1 Kings chapter 1. 1 Kings chapter 1, we notice that David has a trouble with his son Absalom, but then Adonijah wants to try to seize the throne from David. Another son of David tries to seize the throne. And Nathan, then the one that had warned them, he goes and tells Bathsheba that this is what's taking place. And says, if you'll remember, we believe and you believe that Solomon is to be a successor to the throne. In his first chapter of Kings, Nathan goes and talks to Bathsheba, and Bathsheba goes and talks to David and says, my Lord, thou swearest by the Lord thy God unto thine handmaid, saying, assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon the throne. And now Adonijah is about to seize that position. So based on Bathsheba coming to David, she convinces him to go ahead and crown Solomon as the king. And that ceremony takes place in 1 Kings, beginning about verse 32. David calls the priest and Nathan, and they go through the ceremony to name Solomon as the king. And you'll see Bathsheba is the one that instigated that with Nathan. Bathsheba was involved in having Solomon named. Now, we see later on when Solomon is serving as king, and he calls for Bathsheba. Bathsheba comes in to see him, his mother, Solomon's mother, that he, you know, everybody goes into Solomon, they bow to this great king, one of the greatest kings ever, one of the smartest, wisest, richest kings. And she goes in to see him, and everybody goes in and bows to King Solomon. When his mother walks in the room, Solomon bows down to her. This is his mother. And he goes and asks a special chair be brought up, kind of a second throne brought up, sit next to him. And he has his mother sit next to him on the throne. This is the honor that Solomon himself, the king, gave to his mother. Is he bowed down to her, and he had that type of an appreciation. But we see Bathsheba came from a godly home, very godly, very strong. She worked with David, worked with Solomon, and she was honored by the Lord, blessed by the Lord in her marriage to David, blessed by the Lord in not only Solomon her son, but Nathan her son. Both were in the lineage of Jesus. So we see a different picture of Bathsheba when we actually go start reading the scriptures. Go with me now where we're going to end up. You know, we notice that Proverbs was written by Solomon. Go with me to Proverbs chapter 31. I'll spend the rest of my time here, short period of time. Proverbs chapter 31. We're all familiar with Proverbs chapter 31 because it talks about the virtuous woman. Solomon wrote this great proverb about the virtuous woman. You know, now, if we look at Solomon's life, you can go back in 2 Kings and see that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And he's writing about the virtuous woman, you know, and you kind of go, give me a break. You know, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Let's look at that. Go back with me to Proverbs 31, verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. Now, first of all, there's no King Lemuel in Israel history, none whatsoever. Lemuel, if you'll read the Jewish history, Lemuel was the name that Bathsheba gave her son Solomon because he was marrying all these women, especially when he married the daughters of Pharaoh. Solomon, to build the temple, made a lot of deals. He was the big deal maker. You know, we've got a president who claims he's a deal maker today. He wasn't anything compared to Solomon. Solomon made a deal with the king of Lebanon so he could get all those cedars of Lebanon to build. He made deals with all these kingdoms around him, and he married a lot of women. That was the thing you did. You would take the daughter of these kings, and you would marry her as a deal for the king, and it was an honor to be married to Solomon. You can go read where the Queen of Sheba even came to visit Solomon because she was amazed and in awe of him and his wisdom and his riches. So it was a great honor for all these kings that heard the great reputation of Solomon to have their daughter marry him. So part of it was deal making. Solomon ended up with 700 wives and 300 concubines. If you read Jewish history, Bathsheba gave him this pet name of Lemuel because you're marrying all these women that are going to cause you problems. And Lemuel is a pet name that was given to him by Bathsheba. So when it talks about King Lemuel, that's talking about King Solomon. And Solomon wrote these, but look, the words of King Lemuel, the words of Solomon, the prophecy that his mother taught him. Now what we're fixing to go into in verse 31 was taught by Bathsheba. Bathsheba taught this to Solomon. And look what she says. What, my son? Now if you look that now and have Bathsheba as the speaker, look how sense it makes. What, my son? And what the son of my womb? And what the son of my vows? She's talking about her son. She says, now verse 3, she starts giving him advice. Remember, that's what it said. This is taught to him by his mother. Give not thy strength unto women, nor the ways to that which destroyeth kings. She's fixing to advise him in here about the two greatness weaknesses of Solomon, and as we know, probably most of the men in the world. Women and wine. Women and drink, strong drink. Those are the two things she's fixed to advise him. We know that's two of the biggest weaknesses most men in this world have, and it's good advice for all of us, and that's what she's fixing to give him. It's good advice not only for Solomon, but it's good advice for all of us men. She said, give not thy strength unto women, nor the ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink. It's not good advice for especially the leadership to drink. Unless they drink and forget the law. You're going to drink and get drunk, become alcoholic, and you're going to forget the law that you're supposed to be enforcing. You forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. This is Bathsheba giving advice to her son, the king. Don't drink too much. It's going to pervert the laws that you're supposed to be enforcing and doing judgment on the people. But she said, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. You're not going to take care of those people that need the law if you drink too much. She says, but do give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish. You give someone drink so it helps them soothe and get out of their pain. We know when we die today, they've gone to morphine, but it's the same thing she's talking about here. It's you give that kind of stuff to someone who's about to die to ease them of their pain. And wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. You let them forget their misery a little bit. That's who wine is for, and that's who drink is for. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. She says, and then gives him more advice. Open thy mouth for the dumb, those that can't speak for themselves, in the cause of all such that is appointed to destruction. You've got people that are dumb that don't know better. We've got a lot of people, and I see it, and we've seen it in the law, and it's a big debate now. We've got people that are getting themselves deeply in debt because they don't know not to charge on credit cards. How easy is it to get a credit card? I get them in the mail every day. They want me to run up my credit. How easy it is to sign that up and go out and charge it up because I don't know better. And then the debt collectors are coming after me. If you go to these people that will give you payday loans today, come in here and give us a loan and we'll pay it back. And come in here and do a tax return. If you're getting a tax return, come in and they'll charge you huge interest. And if you want to buy a car, you go down and try to buy it for cash, especially the used car dealers. They don't want to sell it to you for cash. They want to sell it to you on credit. And the credit is high. And if you miss a payment or late on a payment, it goes up. That's what she's talking about. There's a lot of people who cannot take or not smart enough in this world to take care of themselves. That's who you got to take care of, and it's what you got to judge, those that can't take care of themselves. I see it more in finances these days than any. I ran a series on financial advice, tried to, in the Banner of Love here a while back, because there's so many people that get themselves heavily in debt to credit cards. There's a lot of people that I know that are very close to me. They've gotten themselves in debt, and then you can't get out because the interest payments are so big, you barely pay your interest. People that make payday loans, you go into these little loans, they're loan sharks. It's what we used to call them. Interest rates at 20 and 30 and 40%. And you can, once you get in debt, you can't ever get out without getting ahead of them. And that's what she's talking about. And there's people in this world that are not smart enough to see those business interests. I visited over the phone yesterday with someone who got in trouble and got into debt collecting. When they did, they got into their bank accounts, got into credit cards, and they paid off their debt by running up the credit card. You're paying using Visa to pay MasterCard type of concept. That's what she's saying. You're the judge. Keep yourself straight and sober as the leader of this country to take care of those people who can't take care of themselves. Open thy mouth for the dumb of the cause, those that can't speak, that don't know how to speak for themselves and can't speak for themselves. They don't have a loud enough voice. And for all such as are appointed to destruction, open thy mouth to judge righteously and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. We've got a lot of people who don't get spoken for. Then he goes in verse 10, and she's telling them, you know, don't drink, keep yourself sober at all times as the leader of this country. It's great advice. I wish congressmen, you know, and everybody run for office could come back and read these things. Verse 10, it says, and who can find a virtuous woman? Giving Solomon advice. This is coming from Bathsheba. Remember, this is not written by Solomon. This is written by his mother who's advising him. Says, go find you a virtuous woman. She's given some of the best advice to young men looking for wives here. And this is the woman who's got the questionable past, who history has kind of put in the wrong column, in my opinion. She's one of the best role models for women I think we could have. She made a mistake, but the Lord has blessed that. He's forgiven it, and he's honored that marriage and honored her children, putting them in the lineage of Christ. Plus, she's given not only Solomon great wisdom, but this is the mother of Solomon still instructing him. He's supposed to be the wisest man other than Christ, the wisest man in the history of the world. The Lord blessed him that way, and yet this is his mother giving advice to the smartest man in the history of the world, the wisest man. Who can find a virtuous woman for a price as far above rubies? She's saying, you picked out 700 wives and 300 concubines. This is how you need to pick out a wife. The heart of her husband does safely trust in her so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. I'll skip through this. I don't want to read it all. But verse 15, she rises also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. You know, we all tease our wives every now and then about cooking us breakfast and bringing it to bed, and we know that doesn't work. And sometimes us husbands ought to do that for our wives. But we know when there's a problem, when there's children at home, when we got company in the house, it's the mother that gets up early, works the night before, and gets ready to prepare the meals to come in. She's given great advice through here, but I'll skip to this and go to the end. Verse 26, she opened her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. Now, the mothers are the teachers of our children. They give us the law. They teach us our manners. My mother taught me not only how to cook a meal, but where to put the fork and the knife and the spoon. Actually showed me how to sit down. My mother got me when I didn't have fingers to cut and showed and worked with me a long time, teaching me how so I could cut my steak and how I could button my shirt and tie my shoes when I didn't have enough fingers to do so, but taught me how to do that. That was my mother in the quietness of our home. That's the mother's work, and the mother does that. We know our mothers are the ones that teach. Many times we have good situations where we have good homeschooling. It's the mothers that are in charge of that and do by far the most of it. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. We've had Mother's Day since 1870, mostly because of men, boys, no matter how old they are, boys worshiping their mothers. They rise up and praise their mothers. We praise our mothers when we get older, much more than when we do young. I thought my mother was wrong in so many times. Now I look back and I think, I still need her advice from time to time. I wish I could call on her today. You know, she was so wrong in so many times. She was wrong, I know, when she took me out of church and busted my bottom two or three times for not behaving. Now I wish I had her back. Now I wish I had her back to call on because of her great wisdom. Many daughters have done virtually, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. You know, most women, I believe, are beautiful and attractive, especially as they're young. I think so many of them grow with grace, but the Lord tells us here, Solomon tells us, and Bathsheba tells us, but beauty is not important. Beauty, favor is deceitful. Somebody that talks smooth and sounds good, that's deceitful. Beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. The woman that feareth the Lord. You come into church this morning, you display the fact that you're the woman here that Bathsheba was talking about. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. This is not coming from Solomon. We give Solomon the credit for this. If you go back and read the first verse, it's Bathsheba that is writing this to her son. Bathsheba is laying out the traits of a virtuous woman. She has the experience and the training to do so. She was raised in a godly home. She had a problem in her life in which she probably was looked down upon for so long. And we've carried that over without really going and reading the scriptures carefully. We've kind of given a black eye to Bathsheba, and yet she was a virtuous woman. She was the one responsible for Solomon becoming king, instigating that and doing that. But she came from a great godly family and gave wonderful godly advice about who a virtuous woman is. You've been kind to me with your attention. We need to bless all our mothers today. I know from, again, my experience with working with telephone companies, this is the highest volume call day every year is Mother's Day. More long-distance calls are made on Mother's Day in the evening than any other day of the year, even business calls. This is the one sole incident in which more calls are made than any. We do honor our mothers. We should honor our mothers. We've got wonderful examples in the Bible. Sometimes we overlook them because we think we know what the scriptures say. The Sadducees thought they knew what the scriptures say when they say there is no resurrection. Christ taught them otherwise, and he does teach them otherwise in there. Not only do he teach them that there is a resurrection, but he says the very first words out of the Lord's mouth to Moses. If it was in the law of Moses, they believed it. If it wasn't, they didn't believe it. He goes back and shows them the very first words out of the Lord's mouth. about I am the father of Abraham and Isaac. I'm the father of I'm the God of the living, not the dead. He said, I'm the God of the living. And all these people he referred to were dead. We thought they were dead, but he says, no, they're alive. They're living today. He taught them that there is a resurrection by the very first words out of that Moses heard directly from the Lord. We have great examples in the Bible of teaching. We err when we don't read the scriptures. It's like Bathsheba. It's like our mothers. We give her a black eye, and yet she was a real role model for mothers. Y'all have been kind with your attention, and my prayers, the Lord will richly bless each of you. Do we have a song, Brother Gary?